This COE is based on the New York State appellate decisions that were released in January of 2020 and dealt with criminal law. Selected decisions were summarized and the summaries were posted on the New York Appellate Digest website in January 2020. Those summaries have since been compiled into the January 2020 criminal law update. And it is that update pamphlet which serves as the written materials for the course, and the page references are to the pamphlet. First case is People v. Johnson on page 5. It deals with the requirements for an appeal. The Third Department held that county court had not issued a written order with respect to the defendant's risk assessment under the Sex Offender Registration Act, and therefore the appeal was not properly before the court. The court wrote, "It is a statutory requirement that county court render an order setting forth its determinations and findings of fact and conclusions of law on which the determinations are based." That's Correction Law Section 168N. That written order must be entered and filed in the office of the clerk of the court where the action is triable, and that's CPLR 2220. Although the record before us contains a decision of county court that sets forth its findings of fact and conclusions of law, the court did not issue a written order, and the risk assessment instrument does not contain the so ordered language so as to constitute an appealable order. Absent any order by the court, this appeal is not properly before us and must be dismissed. Next is People v. James on page 6. Again, it deals with appeals. This case was reversed based on the weight of the evidence. The Second Department, reversing defendant's conviction, held that the identification evidence was too weak to support the conviction in this robbery case. The conviction was deemed to be against the weight of the evidence. The court said, "In this one witness identification case, the complainant consistently had difficulty remembering the details of the crime. She could not remember how she described the defendant, and when asked how she recognized him, she said, by his shirt. The description she provided of the perpetrator shortly after the incident did not match in several ways the defendant's actual physical characteristics and appearance. Moreover, at the time of his arrest, several minutes after the incident, the defendant possessed neither the money nor the personal items which had allegedly been taken from the complainant." So the appellate court reversed, finding that the identification evidence, was not sufficient to support the conviction. Next is People v. Tucker on page 7. It's a constitutional issue dealing with a statute. The Fourth Department, in a full-fledged opinion by Justice Perodotto, held that the statute prohibiting possession of an unlicensed firearm in the house does not violate the Second Amendment. The court said, "New York has substantial, indeed compelling, governmental interests in public safety and crime prevention. Those concerns include the state's substantial and legitimate interest and indeed grave responsibility in ensuring the safety of the general public from individuals who, by their conduct, have shown that they should not be entrusted with a dangerous instrument. The criminal prohibition on the unlicensed possession of a handgun, including in the home, bears a substantial relationship to the state's interests. In the context of firearm regulation, the legislature is far better equipped than the judiciary to make sensitive public policy judgments within constitutional limits concerning the dangers in carrying and possessing firearms and the manner to combat those risks." Next is People v. Beaton, which is on pages 8 and 9. It's one of the first cases to address the new discovery laws enacted in January of 2020 in the criminal procedure law. The Second Department, in one of the first decisions under the new discovery provisions of the criminal procedure law, after an expedited review by Justice Shankman, pursuant to CPL 245.70, reversing Supreme Court, held the protective order prohibiting defense access to the names, addresses, and other identifying information of witnesses in this rape-murder case must be vacated without prejudice. The court wrote, Criminal Procedure Law Section 245.70 Subdivision 1 provides that upon showing of good cause by either party, the court may order that disclosure and inspection be denied, restricted, conditioned, or deferred, or make such order as appropriate. The court is now specifically permitted to condition discovery on making the information available only to counsel for the defendant, that's Criminal Procedure Law 245.70 Subdivision 1. Alternatively, the court is permitted to order defense counsel or persons employed by the attorney or appointed by the court to assist in the defense not to disclose physical copies of discoverable documents to the defendant or anyone else, subject to the defendant being able to access redacted copies at a supervised location. Should the court restrict access to discovery by the defendant personally, the court is required to inform the defendant on the record that counsel is not permitted by law to disclose the material or information to the defendant. This case is one of the first under this new review procedure. The threshold question is what standard is the intermediate appellate justice to apply in performing the expedited review? The statute is silent on that subject. This justice accepts the proposition that where a pure question of law is concerned, the reviewing justice decides the question de novo. Where, however, the issue involves balancing the defendant's interest in obtaining information for defense purposes against concerns for witness safety and protection, the question is appropriately framed as whether the determination made by the trial court was a provident exercise of discretion. The people's affirmation was unaccompanied by any affidavit from anyone with personal or direct knowledge of the relevant circumstances. While alleging that a witness had been approached in person and by use of social media by associates of the defendant, the people did not set forth the name of any such associate, the relationship between the defendant and any associate, the date or approximate date of the alleged improper approach, or even a general description of the incident. While the use of social media is alleged, no screenshot or other depiction of the communication was provided. Further, the four corners of the affirmation do not contain the identity of the witness subject to the contact that caused concern. In short, the sealed affirmation submitted to justify the issuance of the protective order is vague, speculative, and conclusory. Under these circumstances, the affirmation was legally insufficient to support the granting of the relief sought. Next is People v. Reyes. It's on page 9. It's another expedited review discovery court case. Second Department, after an expedited review pursuant to the new Criminal Procedure Law, Section 245.70, vacated the protective order and remitted the matter to allow the defense to oppose the application for a protective order. The court wrote, I conclude that the Supreme Court should have afforded defense counsel an opportunity to be heard on the people's application for a protective order. Accordingly, the application by the defendant is granted, the Supreme Court's ruling and protective order are vacated, and the matter is remitted to the Supreme Court to afford defendants an opportunity to make arguments to that court with respect to the people's application for a protective order and for a new determination of that application. Next is People v. Nash on pages 12 and 13. It's another expedited review discovery case, Second Department. In an expedited review of Supreme Court's granting a protective order in a murder case, held Supreme Court did not abuse its discretion, in part because defense counsel was notified of the ex parte proceeding. The court wrote, It would have been better, in my view, to allow defense counsel to see the portions of the people's written application that contained legal argument or other matter that would not reveal the information sought to be covered by the protective order, pending the court's determination as to whether the sensitive portions of the people's application should be sealed. Further, it would have been better, in my view, even assuming that portions of the people's written and oral presentations should be sealed, to permit defense counsel to participate in portions of the protective order proceeding where the substance of the sealed information is not discussed. In my view, defense counsel should be excluded from participation in the protective order review process only to the extent necessary to preserve the confidentiality of sensitive information pending the court's determination as to the issuance and scope of the protective order. So in that case, the ex parte application for a protective order was upheld, but the judge indicated a preference to allow defense counsel to participate to the extent possible. Next is People versus Martinez on 13 and 14. It's a motion to vacate the conviction based on ineffective assistance of counsel for failure to inform the defendant of the potential for deportation. The First Department, in a full-fledged opinion by Justice Renwick, reversing Supreme Court, held the defendant, Martinez, was entitled to a hearing on his CPL 44010 motion to vacate his 2007 judgment of conviction. At the time defendant pled guilty, the court warned him there could be immigration consequences. But defense counsel told him he wouldn't have to worry about deportation if he stayed out of trouble while on probation. In fact, however, deportation was mandatory. Supreme Court denied the motion based in part on defendant's motivation for it, that being the expansion of his taxi business in Massachusetts. The First Department noted that plaintiff's current motivation for the motion to vacate is irrelevant. The matter was sent back for a hearing in front of a different judge. The court wrote, "In the context of a guilty plea, the ultimate question of prejudice is whether there was a reasonable probability that a reasonable person in defendant's circumstances would have gone to trial if given constitutionally adequate advice. A defendant must convince the court that a decision to reject the plea bargain would have been rational. In that regard, appropriate factors to be weighed include evidence of defendant's incentive at the time of his plea to remain in the United States rather than his native country, his respective family and employment ties at the time of his plea to the United States as compared to his country of origin, the strength of the people's case, and defendant's sentencing exposure. In answering the prejudice question, judges should be cognizant that a non-citizen defendant confronts a very different calculus than confronts a United States citizen. For a non-citizen defendant, preserving his right to remain in the United States may be more important to him than any jail sentence. Thus, a determination of whether it would be rational for a defendant to reject a plea offer must take into account the particular circumstances informing the defendant's desire to remain in the United States." On the record before this court, there's reason to believe that Martinez would have given paramount importance to avoiding deportation if he had known that it was more than a mere possibility, but was an unavoidable consequence of his plea to an aggravated felony. Evidence regarding Martinez's background completely supports his current assertion that his main focus has always been to remain in the United States. This much is undisputed: his long history in the United States, his efforts to become a citizen, his family circumstances, and his gainful employment in Massachusetts all signal his strong connection to and desire to remain in the United States. So again, the appellate court ruled that Martinez was entitled to a hearing on his motion to vacate his conviction. Next, on pages 14 and 15, People versus Guillen, G-U-I-L-L-E-N. It's a juror misconduct case. The First Department, ordering a hearing, held a juror's expression of romantic interest in a member of the prosecution team could amount to disqualifying juror misconduct. Allegations about another juror's close relationship with a witness also warranted a hearing. The defense had moved to set aside the verdict alleging juror misconduct. The court said, "The court improvidently exercised its discretion in denying without a hearing that branch of defendant's motion to set aside the verdict on the ground of alleged misconduct by two jurors," citing Criminal Procedure Law 330.40. The people's trial preparation assistant, who assisted the trial prosecutors, disclosed that sometime after the trial and before sentencing, he received a handwritten note in the mail from the jury foreperson stating now that the trial is over. Followed by the juror's first and last name, her juror number, the court part in which the trial had occurred, her phone number, and her address. The note also included a crossed-out phrase from which it could be inferred that the original version of the note had been written during the trial. Under the circumstances, the note itself was sufficient evidence to raise an issue of fact about whether the four persons' apparent romantic interest in the trial preparation assistant prevented her from deliberating fairly. The assistant's affidavit stating that he did not respond to the juror's note or otherwise communicate with her at any time is not dispositive, as the issue is the juror's misconduct or bias during the trial. The court also erred with regard to a second juror. That juror had a sufficiently close relationship with a witness to warrant a hearing as to whether that juror engaged in misconduct by failing to disclose the relationship to the court. Next is People v. Allain on page 15. It's another case relating to jurors. Second Department, reversing defendant's conviction, held the trial judge should not have discharged a juror and replaced her with an alternate after the proof had closed and before summations. The juror was not unavailable within the meaning of Criminal Procedure Law Section 270.35. The court wrote, after both sides had rested but before summations, the Supreme Court, over the defendant's objection, excused juror number 10 and replaced her with an alternate on the basis that juror number 10 had to travel to Maryland for an evening work obligation the next day, which was a Friday. The day after the alternate was substituted, the jury found defendant guilty of assault in the first degree and criminal possession of a weapon in the fourth degree. The defendant's statutory and constitutional rights were violated when, over the defendant's objection, the court excused juror number 10 and substituted an alternate juror. The record does not demonstrate that juror number 10 was unavailable, as that term is used in Criminal Procedure Law, Section 270.35. Juror number 10's work obligation did not render her unavailable for jury service, as her own convenience or potential financial hardship are insufficient to render her unavailable under CPL 270.35. Next is Matter of Bannister. It's another case involving the improper release of a juror. First Department, granting petitioner's application for a writ of prohibition and dismissing the indictment, held the trial court should not have sua sponte declared a mistrial to accommodate a juror's weekend travel plans, and retrial was therefore barred. The court wrote, the trial court was not compelled by manifest necessity to declare a mistrial and terminate the proceedings, and accordingly, retrial is barred under the double jeopardy clauses of the federal and state constitutions. It was an abuse of discretion to declare a mistrial in order to accommodate a juror's weekend travel plans, including a Friday, which he belatedly informed the court about during deliberations, where the court, as requested by defendant, reasonably could have directed the juror to report for deliberations the following day. And the court also failed to confirm that the jury was hopelessly deadlocked at the time. So the mistrial should not have been granted in that case, and the writ of prohibition prevented a second prosecution. Next is People v. Hayden Larson on pages 17 and 18. It's a search and seizure case involving the inevitable discovery doctrine. Fourth Department held the inevitable discovery doctrine did not apply to a so-called diabetes bag seized by the police. The bag should have been suppressed, but the error was found to be harmless. The court wrote, on the day of his arrest, a police officer pulled defendant's vehicle over for failing to signal. Defendant had a passenger with him. After approaching the vehicle, the officer observed that defendant appeared to be under the influence of drugs and placed him under arrest. The passenger was also arrested. At a suppression hearing, the officer testified that after she arrested defendant and seated him in her patrol car, defendant indicated that he had diabetes medication in his vehicle. defendant did not give the officer permission to retrieve the bag of medication from his vehicle or say that he needed it at that time, nor did he give her permission to open the bag. The officer testified that she retrieved the bag for defendant because defendant would be allowed to access to, would be allowed access to certain medication in lockup. She did not intend to give the bag to defendant while he was in the patrol car. The officer looked in the bag and found needles, narcotics, and some residue, not diabetes medication. Defendant's vehicle was subsequently impounded pursuant to Buffalo Police Department written policy. During the inventory search of the vehicle, the officers recovered methamphetamine. The court said, "We agree with defendant that the court erred in refusing to suppress the evidence obtained from the diabetes bag pursuant to the inevitable discovery doctrine. The contents of the diabetes bag that defendant sought to suppress was the very evidence that was obtained as the immediate consequence of the challenged police conduct." So the inevitable discovery doctrine was inapplicable. Next is the matter of State of New York versus Robert G. It's a sentencing case. It's on page 18. Third Department held defendant, a sex offender who was found to suffer from a mental abnormality after mental hygiene law Article 10 trial, was not entitled to specific performance of his plea agreement, which made no mention of the potential mental hygiene law proceedings. The court wrote, "It is well settled that trial courts are required to advise defendants who plead guilty regarding the direct consequences of such plea, but they have no obligation to iterate every collateral consequence of the conviction. As relevant here, the potential for either civil confinement or supervision pursuant to the Sex Offender Management and Treatment Act is a collateral consequence of a guilty plea, and therefore the current state of the law does not require that defendants be informed of it prior to entering a plea." So when a defendant pleads to a sex offense, there's no requirement that he or she be informed at sentencing of the possibility of confinement pursuant to the mental hygiene law. Next is People v. Blanford on pages 20 and 21. It deals with sentencing, and in this case, an enhanced sentence. The Third Department held the sentencing court should not have imposed an enhanced sentence because the record did not demonstrate defendant was warned that the use of drugs while on furlough would result in a stiffer sentence. The court wrote, "A court may not impose an enhanced sentence unless it has informed the defendant of specific conditions that the defendant must abide by or risk such enhancement. A review of the transcript of all the proceedings, including those at which defendant entered his guilty plea, reflects that although he received warnings that certain conduct could result in an enhanced sentence of up to 9 years on the first indictment, he was never advised that a positive drug test could result in an enhanced sentence. Given that the furlough was granted off the record before us does not not disclose what, if any, warnings were provided to defendant prior to his release on furlough. Moreover, when defendant objected to the enhanced sentence, the court did not advise him of the right to a hearing to contest the alleged violation. And the record does not contain the positive drug test results, the testing date, or any evidence as to when defendant consumed these drugs so as to establish that it occurred during the six-hour furlough. Accordingly, the sentences imposed upon the first indictment must be vacated and the matter remitted to county court to either impose the original agreed-upon sentence or give defendant an opportunity to withdraw his plea to that indictment." Next is People v. Pittman on page 21. It's a Sex Offender Registration Act case dealing with the proof required before the people's application for an upward departure can be granted. The Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held the people's application for an upward departure was not supported by clear and convincing evidence. Evidence that defendant was charged but not indicted or convicted does not meet the clear and convincing standard. The court said, "An upward departure could not properly be based upon certain prior conduct of which the defendant was charged, but either never indicted or never convicted, as the people's evidence regarding that alleged conduct did not meet the clear and convincing evidence standard. Next is People v. Miller on page 22. It's another Sex Offender Registration Act case where the underlying offenses occurred in two different counties and SORA proceedings were held in both of those counties. The Fourth Department held there should not be more than one SORA risk assessment for convictions stemming from the same course of conduct and based upon the same risk assessment instrument. The first risk assessment was in Allegheny County and designated defendant a level 2 risk. The second risk assessment was in Cattaraugus County and designated defendant a level 3 risk based upon the evidence. The Cattaraugus County assessment was vacated. The court wrote, defendant was convicted in Cattaraugus County Court upon his plea of guilty of attempted sodomy in the second degree, and that same year he was convicted in Allegheny County upon his plea of guilty to sexual abuse. The conviction stemmed from a course of conduct against one victim that occurred in both jurisdictions. So there can't be more than one risk assessment based on the same risk assessment instrument. Next is People v. Guzzi on page 23. It involves the Son of Sam law. Third Department held the Son of Sam law trumped the CPLR, the Retirement and Social Security law, and the Administrative Code of the City of New York with respect to the pension of a former New York City police officer who was convicted of murder and attempted murder and against whom plaintiff obtained a personal injury judgment of more than $1 million. The court wrote, this court has found that CPLR 5205 subdivision C is superseded by the Son of Sam law. Defendant's assertions that the Retirement and Social Security law section 110 and the Administrative Code of the City of New York, sections 13-264, protect his pension from assignment to satisfy plaintiff's money judgment are similarly without merit due to the broad reach of the Son of Sam law. Next is People v. Stone on page 24. It has to do with statements by co-defendants tried at the same time. Third Department reversing defendant's conviction held the redacted statement of the co-defendant should not have been admitted in evidence because it was clear the redacted portions referred to the defendant and were inculpatory. Defendant's right to confront the witnesses against him was therefore violated. Next is People v. Kamenev on pages 25 and 26. There's a brief mention of an appellate issue here that I thought was worth mentioning. The Second Department, reversing defendant's murder conviction and ordering a new trial, held that the identification evidence was too weak to constitute probable cause for defendant's arrest. Therefore, defendant's motion to suppress his statement should have been granted. And here's the appellate issue. The court noted that the people's argument that defendant was not in custody when the statements were made could not be considered because the issue was not ruled upon by the trial court. So an argument raised by the prosecution in a defendant's appeal that was not ruled upon by the trial court below cannot be considered by the appellate court. Next is the Elric case on pages, People v. Elric on pages 26 and 27. And it represents a fairly significant change in the law. Third Department, departing from its precedent based upon a recent November 2019 ruling by the Court of Appeals, held the failure to include the date, approximate time, or place of the charged offense in a superior court information and or in the waiver of appeal is not a jurisdictional defect. The court wrote, defendant's sole contention on this appeal, which the people have conceded based upon this court's decision in People v. Bush-Scardino, is that the waiver of indictment is invalid and the Superior Court information is jurisdictionally defective for failing to set forth the approximate time of the charged offense in accordance with CPL 195.20. Indeed, that has been the standard we have applied since Bush-Scardino, and we further recognize that this is not a case where the time of the offense is unknown or perhaps unknowable. The Court of Appeals recently addressed the validity of appeal waivers in three consolidated appeals. And in one of the appeals, the court also addressed the validity of that defendant's waiver of indictment with respect to charges involving child sexual abuse. That was People v. Lang. The reasoning of Lang requires this court to reassess and abandon the standard enunciated in Bush-Scardino. Lang instructs that we should look not only at the waiver of indictment and the Superior Court information, but also at the local accusatory instruments to ascertain whether adequate notice was provided. Here, the felony complaint mirrors both the waiver and the Superior Court information by providing the date and specific address, but without specifying the approximate time. Nonetheless, defendant raised no objection before county court, made no demand for a bill of particulars, and lodges no claim that he lacked notice of the precise crime for which he waived prosecution by indictment. In context, we conclude that the defect here was not jurisdictional and that defendant forfeited his challenge upon his plea of guilty. At this point, I'm going to insert the verification code to be placed on your attorney affirmation for this January 2020 Criminal Law Update CLE. The verification code is tampering. Again, the verification code to be placed on your attorney affirmation for this January 2020 Criminal Law Update CLE is tampering. Next is People v. Zachary, which is on page 28. It's a tampering with evidence case. The Second Department held that defendants discarding a bag of marijuana as he was being pursued by a police officer for violating the city's open container law constituted attempted tampering with physical evidence. The court wrote, contrary to the people's contention, the defendant's act of discarding the bag did not constitute an act of concealment within the meaning of Penal Law 215.40 Subdivision 2. Nevertheless, since the defendant engaged in conduct that tends to affect and comes dangerously near to accomplishing an act of concealment intended to suppress the physical evidence, there is legally sufficient evidence to sustain a conviction of attempted tampering with physical evidence, and it cites Penal Law Sections 110 and 215.40 Subdivision 2. So again, just throwing away a bag of marijuana was sufficient for a conviction for attempted tampering with evidence. And the final case on page 29 is People v. Martin. It has to do with the proper statutory criteria to be applied in a motion to vacate a conviction. First Department, reversing Supreme Court, held defendant's motion to vacate his judgment of conviction should not have been denied without a hearing. There was a question of fact whether defense counsel was aware he could call an expert to testify defendant who had ingested drugs did not have the required mental state, which was depraved indifference. The First Department noted Supreme Court may have improperly relied on Criminal Procedure Law Section 440.30 Subdivision D, which applies only if the motion is based solely on an allegation by the defendant, which was not the case here. So on that issue, the court wrote, to the extent the court may have been relying on Criminal Procedure Law 440.30D, that section permits summary denial, that's denial without a hearing, when there is no reasonable possibility that such an allegation is true. But it applies only when the allegation is made solely by the defendant. That is not the case here, where the allegation at issue regarding trial counsel's statements was made by defendant's motion counsel based on his own knowledge. So the court applied the wrong criteria when it decided no hearing on the motion to vacate was necessary. And that concludes this January 2020 Criminal Law Update CLE.